Isaiah, chapters 54 and 55, and History and the Style of Isaiah. The 34th talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on May 18, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 4, History and the Style of Isaiah, accompanies this talk.
I have a lot that I'm planning to do today. I don't know if we'll get through it all. This is my last week in my stint here. I'll be taking a break for a few months. I want to do Isaiah 54 and 55, because then that brings us up to 56. That's a nice break there, and so that'll be a nice place to cut it off. I didn't finish what I wanted to talk about last week, so I'm tacking that on to the end here. So my hope is to go through 54 and 55 quickly, and then I'm hoping to get to the comments that I wanted to make last week. So we'll see how it goes. The section that we're looking at, that we've been going through for the last few weeks, started in chapter 40, and it goes up to through 55. Prior to that, the first 39 chapters of Isaiah is full of recriminations and condemnations of Israel. That's the dominant tone, is God is reprimanding Israel and telling them that there are going to be punishments coming their way. There are other things in the chapter, those chapters, obviously, but that's kind of the dominant tone. In chapter 40, it shifts in tone, and there is more of the emphasis on comfort to Israel, that God is going to bring about his purposes, and his purposes with respect to Israel are good, and in fact, Israel has a glorious future that is coming and is assured. That towards the end of that section, as we talked about last week, there are the four what are called the servant songs. And the last of those servant songs is in 52 and 53. And the way that it culminates is when it says in I'll just read verse 11, "My servant will justify the many as he will bear their iniquities." So this servant is going to bear the iniquities of the many. So now when we get into 54 and 55, the tone changes and is even more upbeat than it has been up to now. And in some ways is almost celebratory. So let's look at the first section of chapter 54. "Shout for joy, O barren one, you who have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting and cry aloud, you who have not travailed. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Spare not. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your pegs. For you will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your descendants will possess nations, and they will resettle the desolate cities." This section is picking up on some imagery that's been used earlier in this section. It started when God said with respect to Babylon, Babylon was saying, "I will never be childless, I will never be widowed." And God said, "You will be childless and you will be widowed. Those very things are going to come upon you." Then later, Isaiah says that Israel will have children beyond number. She's been deprived of her children now, but in the future she will have children beyond number. So kind of it turns that image towards Israel and says, you will have lots of kids. And that is continued here in 54, that this barren one is to shout for joy because she will have children beyond number. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married one, says the Lord. Therefore, they need to do some additions onto their tent. Enlarge the tent, extend it out, because you're going to have lots of kids that you're going to have to accommodate. You will spread abroad to the right and to the left. Those kids are going to be all over the place. And your descendants will possess nations, and they will resettle the desolate cities. That seems to be hearkening back to a promise in Deuteronomy, where it was said that the descendants of Israel would possess nations. Okay, so this is a promise then, that this is a joyous thing that will happen to Israel. Israel will have sons beyond number. Next section. Fear not, for you will not be put to shame. Neither feel humiliated, for you will not be disgraced. But you will forget the shame of your youth, and the reproach of your widowhood you will remember no more. For your husband is your Maker, whose name is the Lord of hosts, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth. For the Lord has called you, like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, even like a wife of one's youth, when she is rejected, says your God. For a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In an outburst of anger I hid my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting loving kindness I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. So now, speaking to this, to Zion, this woman, you will not be put to shame. It was considered shameful to be childless. And Zion is like one who is childless. And God says, fear not, you will not be put to shame. That shame will be taken away. You will forget the shame of your youth. So for a while you are childless, but that will end. You will have an abundance of children. And the reproach of your widowhood you will remember no more. So Isaiah is likening Zion to a widow, a childless widow. But that's going to change. Your husband is your Maker. That is Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the husband of Zion. And your Redeemer. So it's as though God is going to be the Redeemer husband for Zion, as in Ruth, Boaz is the Redeemer husband for Ruth. In verse 6, it's interesting. It says, for the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, even like a wife of one's youth when she is rejected. So the imagery is changing from Zion being like a widow whose husband has died and she has no husband, has no children. Now it's changed to a woman whose husband has left her, even like a wife of one's youth when she is rejected, says your Lord. So it's changing the imagery. In the first one, it allows God to play the role of Redeemer. In the second one, now it's an image that has God reconciling with the wife of his youth. Then he says, for a brief moment I forsook you. So it was just a short period of time when God turned his back on Israel. It was a temporary thing. But now he's coming back with compassion. His anger is over. Now his loving kindness, his chesed, is everlasting, and he will have compassion on Zion. All of that's changing. What's happening, what Israel is experiencing, the discipline that Israel is experiencing, is all temporary. Now, if you look at the history of Israel, that's a long temporary. That's hundreds of years. But from God's perspective, that is a brief moment. The next section. For this is like the days of Noah to me, when I swore that the waters of Noah should not flood the earth again. So I have sworn that I will not be angry with you, nor will I rebuke you. For the mountains may be removed and the hills may shake, But my loving kindness will not be removed from you, and my covenant of peace will not be shaken, says the Lord, who has compassion on you. So what he's saying here is, the judgments that you have experienced are like the judgment that was experienced during the time of Noah. Yes, it was comprehensive, but it was temporary. And after the flood, God promised, and he put the rainbow in the sky as a sign of his promise. He promised that he would not destroy the earth by a flood again. He wouldn't do that again. And here, Isaiah is saying, or God is saying, as back in the time of Noah, I am making a promise, I will not discipline you again. When this is over, I will not discipline you again. He says, but my loving kindness will not be removed from you, and my covenant of peace will not be shaken. So ultimately, it's temporary, it will end, and it will not be renewed. The rest of the chapter. O afflicted one, storm-tossed and not comforted, behold, I will set your stones in antimony, and your foundations I will lay in sapphires. Moreover, I will make your battlements of rubies and your gates of crystal and your entire wall of precious stones. And all your sons will be taught of the Lord, and the well-being of your sons will be great. In righteousness you will be established. You will be far from oppression, and you will not fear, and from terror, for it will not come near you. If anyone fiercely assails you, it will not be from me. Whoever assails you will fall because of you. Behold, I myself have created the smith who blows the fire of coals and brings out a weapon for its work. And I have created the destroyer to ruin. No weapon that is formed against you shall prosper, and every tongue that accuses you in judgment you will condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord. So this Israel, who has been afflicted and storm-tossed, that's all going to end, and Zion is going to be built with precious stones now, with antimony, sapphires, rubies, crystal, and precious stones. And the sons of Zion, from now on, are going to be taught of God, and they will have great well-being. And Zion will be established in righteousness. Things will be set right without rebelliousness or sin. And oppression and fear are going to be all removed from Zion. That will not be experienced again. No one will be able to assault Zion, because God will guarantee that anyone who tries will fall. And then verse 16 I find interesting. He says, I myself created the smith who created the weapons that came against you, and I myself created the weapon bearer who came against you to destroy you. So God is doubly in control of things. He's control of the weapons that are made, and he is control of the person who bears the weapons. And as a result, there is no way that an assault can come against you, because God is in control of that whole process. Even if someone accuses you, you will condemn them. So they will be fully protected and vindicated. And that's the heritage of the servants of the Lord. Chapter 55, first section. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk, without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and delight yourself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David. Behold, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you will call a nation you do not know, and a nation which knows you not will run to you. Because of the Lord your God, even the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. So he's calling anyone who thirsts, and we've seen this many times in Isaiah, that theme of water and thirstiness. He's calling everyone who thirsts, and those who have no money, come and buy and eat and drink. You don't need money. It's free. Why is it? That's the standing offer. Why is it that you spend money for that which is not bread, which doesn't satisfy, when you can have what really satisfies, what's really what you need to satisfy and fulfill you, and it's available for free, and it's abundant. So he makes an appeal. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you. As he did, as can be seen in the faithful mercies that he presented to David. So just as he made commitments, promises to David, generous commitments and promises to David, he is making a generous offer to his listeners. He says, I have made him, that is David, I believe, a witness to the peoples, a leader and a commander for the peoples. I think what this means is that David was established king of Israel as a demonstration of what happens when God blesses a king. That God acted through David in such a way that he showed to the world what kind of God he was through David and David's successes. So I think that's what it means when it says, I have made him a witness to the peoples. And it's interesting, it's a witness to the peoples. It's a witness to other nations. And these two chapters are really significantly focused towards the nations. Then in verse 5 it says, behold, you will call a nation. The yous that have preceded this in this chapter are all plural, but this one is singular. So I think this is in reference to David or a David, that is, a son of David. This could very well be a reference to the Messiah. Behold, you, I think the Messiah, will call a nation you do not know, and a nation which knows you not will run to you. So it's talking about the Messiah having an appeal that goes beyond the boundaries of Israel. It extends out to the Gentiles. Okay. And the rest of the chapter. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return to the Lord, and he will have compassion on him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. For you will go out with joy and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills will break forth into shouts of joy before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush, the cypress will come up. And instead of the nettle, the myrtle will come up. And it will be a memorial to the Lord for an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. So he makes an appeal at this point, asking his listeners to seek the Lord and to call upon him. And it says, seek the Lord while he may be found. There is a time limit on this offer. There's a certain amount of urgency. Presumably this is the appeal that's made to people as a whole. And it is only good for that time between the forceps and the stone, as Joni Mitchell refers to it. So there is a time limit on this offer. And he says what they are to do is the wicked should forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. So it's both behaviors or mode of life and how one thinks, one's thought life, one's perspectives. So forsake, the wicked are to forsake their way, the unrighteous man is to forsake his thoughts and return to God, who will have compassion and who will abundantly pardon. Now, he goes on to say, for my thoughts are not your thoughts. And I'm not sure exactly what he's explaining here. I would presume that what he's trying to explain is he's anticipating the objection, well, what about our years in exile? What about all this time that we have suffered? Why should I turn to a God who has inflicted so much suffering on our people? I assume that that's what's in the background of this statement. But what he says is, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. There is a distinct difference between the way that God thinks about the world and the way we as human beings think about the world. I don't think it's a different logic, but it's just that God's perspective is so much grander than ours. He knows more. There are more pieces to the puzzle for him than there are for us. And if you take all of those things into account, it's a much different picture than the picture that we see. Ours is very myopic, very narrowly focused. And so it's not surprising that we as human beings would puzzle over why God would do things the way that he does them. But God acts beneficently. God acts compassionately. And he does good consistently. 10 is a metaphor to capture that. That just as the rain comes down, it waters the ground. There's a chain of events that's established by this rain that comes down from heaven, by the way. This is a blessing that comes down from heaven. It waters the ground. The seeds sprout. The plants grow. The plants produce more seed. And that seed that's produced can be eaten as food. And it can be saved to plant another crop for the next year. So there's enormous benefit that comes from the rain falling down from heaven. It's a whole chain of events that are set in motion by that rain coming down from heaven. Similarly, God sends forth his word. And I'm not exactly sure what is being captured by the term word here, what is intended. My best guess is that it's by God's revelation, his proclamation, his making things known to us. His word goes forth, and it is not to no use that word goes forth. It will accomplish what he wants it to accomplish. It will succeed, and it will not return to him empty. God does what he says he will do. God reveals what is true. As a result, for those who respond to God and turn to him, embrace his ways and his thoughts, all of creation will rejoice at that. The mountains and the hills are going to shout for joy, and the trees of the field will clap their hands. I like that imagery. And the thorn bush and the nettle, those plants will be replaced with the cypress and the myrtle. So desert plants will be replaced with trees and with forest. And that transformation of the environment from a desert to a forest is going to be a memorial to the Lord. It's an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. That's a great picture. Okay, so that's the end. That brings us to the end of that section. And when I start teaching again, I'll pick up in 56 and continue then to the end of the book. Okay, now my comments that I didn't get to last week. What I want to do is talk a little bit about the servant songs and how the servant songs are constructed. And I think that if we reflect on how the servant songs are constructed, that it tells us something about how the book of Isaiah is constructed. And I think it also tells us something about history. And that's the stuff that I want to go through. Now, the servant songs, there are four of them. The first one, it just kind of pops up out of nowhere. There's no preface for it. It just shows up. But in the immediate context, prior to it, there are four things that I think are worthy of note. One is it talks about the need of God's people, in particular, their rebelliousness, their fear, and their insecurity. Those are all problems that need to be dealt with. The second thing that the context stresses is the worthlessness of the other gods. The pagan gods, the ones that they're attracted to, they can't do anything. The third is God is deeply committed to blessing his people. And the last, the one that shows up right at just before we have the first servant song, is the lack of anyone who can truly enlighten God's people. So that's the immediate context for the first servant song. And it shows up. And I have written a summary here. I wrote a summary that I passed out last week, but this is a little bit changed. And I'll just read through a summary of each of the four songs. The first one. The first servant song begins with the phrase, "Behold my servant," like he is stepping onto the stage for the first time. It then goes on to describe the servant as a gentle individual who will bring justice, enlightenment, and freedom to the whole world. The second servant song talks about a special person chosen from before birth for his mission. To accomplish this purpose, he has been kept hidden for just the right time when he will speak powerfully and effectively and manifest the glory of God. The servant will experience discouragement, but he will trust God with the outcome. God will reward this faithfulness by expanding the servant's mission from just restoring Israel to God to taking salvation to the whole world. So although he will be despised for a time, the whole world will bow down to him in the end. The third song. The servant is a student of God who is therefore able to speak words of encouragement to the weary. He is obedient to God's instruction and is able to gracefully endure abuse from his enemies because he knows God will vindicate him. Then the last song, the servant will amaze because he will be blessed and honored by God, although he will look like a loser. He will start out vulnerable and plain, and he will be shunned by others because he will look like he is cursed by God. But in fact, his suffering will be because of our wrongdoing, and he will ultimately die because of our sins. He will be honored by God for his faithfulness, and because of his obedience, many will be justified. So that's a summary of the four songs. What I find interesting here, there are lots of things that are interesting, but with respect to the style, what I find interesting is the first song just kind of pops up out of nowhere. You read through it and you get a few clues as to who this servant is and what's going on. But it really raises more questions than it answers. It's just a very puzzling and mysterious thing to pop up in the middle of the text. And it leaves one tempted to give up and not proceed further. Then we have intervening material that is not directly related, it's not unrelated, but it's not obviously directly related. Then we have the second song. And the second song answers one or two of the questions that were raised when we read the first song, but it goes on to raise other questions that the first song didn't raise. And it leaves you in a position where you've made some progress, but in other respects, you're more confused than you were before. That, then, is followed by more intervening material that, again, is not directly related. And it's followed by the third song in which you have the same thing happening. Some questions are answered, other questions are raised. And then more intervening material, and then finally the fourth song, in which, again, there are more questions that are raised. And some questions answered. So the end result is this servant is this mysterious thing that's a little hard to pin down. It's a little hard to figure out exactly what Isaiah is talking about. But there is a more or less vague image that emerges from all of these songs. And we can make these generalizations, these conclusions with respect to the servant. One, he is a gentle, compassionate, confident spokesman for God. The second, he will suffer for us even though we despise him. Third, God will accept the punishment he suffered in the place of our own punishment. And fourth, he will bring salvation to the whole world. So there is something that emerges that you can kind of put your hands around, but there are lots of questions that are raised that are not answered in the four songs. It seems to me that Isaiah has used this style of presentation for the whole book. He'll introduce a concept, and then he'll go on to something else. But he'll come back to that concept, and he'll present it a little bit differently. And then he'll go away from it. And then he'll come back to it. And he just keeps doing that. We saw that even with the little vignettes with respect to the builders, the makers of idols. Four times he gave us that little story of how idols are made. And each time he changes it a little bit to emphasize a different point. And then he moves on. Those are the clearest examples, but I think this pattern is throughout Isaiah. As a result, then you're constantly working with these problems that have been raised by concepts that he's talked about and then moved on from. And you're constantly having to take the questions that are raised and put them on the back burner. Because if you don't move on until you solve those problems, you won't move on. You have to keep putting things on the back burner and just let them sit there while you proceed and hope that it comes back enough that you can answer some of those. As a result, then, the way I envision the way he proceeds through his concepts is in a spiral. He proceeds forward, and then he kind of loops back, and then he proceeds forward, and then he kind of loops back. You're always moving generally in the same direction, that is, forward, but he's always coming back and picking up things that he has introduced at other times. Okay. I think that the style that Isaiah has used in this book is actually an imitation of history. That is, it has been from looking at Isaiah that I have been struck by the fact that history progresses in that same spiral fashion. There are those that say that history is a straight line. There are others who have said that history is cyclical, It seems to me that it's kind of a hybrid of the two. It is kind of cyclical and kind of linear. It's moving forward, but it comes back around. And it does that by repeating events. That there are events that happen way back in history that have echoes, that have similar twin events that keep happening. In Isaiah, in the section that we've been looking at, one obvious example is God saving his people out of slavery. And there are three related events that I think Isaiah really intends us to relate, because he has referred to them as he's talked about the return from Babylonian exile. There was the Exodus. In the Exodus, God led his people out of slavery and took them to a land that he had promised to them. The return from Babylonian exile is similar in that God is taking his people out of slavery and taking them to the land that he has given to them. But they aren't exactly the same. They are different events, and there are some significant differences, and Isaiah even points out some of the differences. If you look at Exodus, I've got written here, Exodus chapter 12, verse 39. This is with respect to the Exodus. It says, they had baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. So they had to hurry. God told them to hurry. And the unleavened bread is a symbol of them having to hurry. And that's preserved in the Passover. But in Isaiah, in Isaiah 52:12, he says, with respect to returning from the exile in Babylon, he says, but you will not go out in haste, nor will you go as fugitives, for the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard. So the return from Babylonian exile is an Exodus-like event, but there are significant differences, and those differences are worthy of note, and I think they're intended to be instructive. Now, I'm not sure what the significance of this fact that they don't go in haste when they leave Babylon. I've just ventured a guess here. It seems to me that in Exodus, God is just introducing himself, and it's not clear to the people of Israel who God is and exactly what his power is and all that sort of thing. That will become clearer later. And as a result, I think God creates a situation where they have to hurry. But in their return from Babylon, they're dealing with a more known quantity. There is trust, or at least there's grounds for trust. There is a history that they can look back on for trust. And therefore, no, they do not have to hurry. God has removed that. In any case, there's a change there. There's a difference in the two situations. And that difference is intended, I think, to be food for thought. And we could look at other kinds of differences. Let me take another set of similar events, I think, and these have been suggested to me by Isaiah. And this is similar to what I just talked about. But the concept in history that I'm looking at here is God as dispeller of chaos. And we've talked about that before in Isaiah as we've gone through. Creation was an event which, at least in part, is there to show us that God is a God who likes order and light. He is the kind of God who comes in where there is darkness and chaos, and he changes that. He dispels that. He puts things right. And in creation, the story of creation in Genesis, I think, teaches us that. And we could go into this in more detail, but I think it's very significant that the creative activity in Genesis doesn't start with nothing. It starts with chaos. And then that is day by day, that is ordered. It's dark chaos. And that is ordered and light is brought to it. And I think we're to understand from that description of the way that God created that what he does is he takes that which is chaotic and he brings order to it. He takes that which is dark and he brings light to it. That's the kind of God he is. That's what he likes to do. And we can see that in the creation story. But as you read through that, it raises a number of questions, and I've listed a few here. So what is God just a neatnik? He just likes things in their places, doesn't want anything out of order. What does it mean for everything to be in its place? Is God primarily interested in physics and chemistry? Are we just talking about the material world that's of interest to him? So we see an event in history, creation, and we gain some information about who God is through that. But it's just a little piece of the puzzle, and it raises at least as many questions as it answers. A creation-like event is Exodus. And the two are likened. We have seen that in Isaiah. In Exodus, God leads the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. So again, God is acting to establish the correct order. And part of the correct order is his people need to be free. So God is dispelling here the chaos of, and I was trying to figure out how to characterize it, and I'm just of antagonism and ignorance towards God is the way I've characterized it. We see Pharaoh destroyed, and then as soon as they're out of Egypt, the law is presented, and the law is likened by Isaiah to light. So these are acts on the part of God in the Exodus event, which are dispelling chaos and bringing light and clarity where there's darkness. But again, the Exodus raises all kinds of other questions. What is this Passover stuff? What's the law all about? Etc. And I could have listed more. We have another Exodus-like event, and that is the coming of the Messiah. I think it's very interesting in Matthew that there are a number of indications, especially in the early chapters of Matthew, that Matthew is likening Jesus to Moses. There are several suggestions that that's the case. So there's a sense in which Jesus coming, that event, has some Exodus-like qualities, and it has some creation-like qualities to it. God sent the Messiah to teach and die on the cross. God addresses the chaos of sin in the event of Jesus. Jesus teaches about how to understand the law. Jesus dies as atonement for our sins. So there are some things that get cleared up there. But there are more questions, and the most significant one, I think, is, but how do we actually become righteous or sanctified? So there is another creation, Exodus, Messiah-like event, chaos-dispelling event yet to come, and that's going to be when the end of history comes. And in that, God is going to deal with the chaos of human rebellion against God. Okay. I've just listed that as an example of the kind of thing that I have in mind when I say that history, that it is spiral. That God likes setting up events and then repeating them, having another event that is similar to it, but there are significant differences. And by putting them together, we gain a broader understanding of what God is doing. It is interesting then that when Isaiah is presenting his prophecy, he does it in a way that's both backward-looking and forward-looking. If we come back to this example of the return from Babylon, he prophesies the return of the Jews from Babylon, and it took place not too long after he had prophesied that. But in prophesying it, He refers to antecedents in the past. I've just talked about that. It is an Exodus-like event in some ways. It is also a creation-like event in some ways. But the return from Babylon is just a dress rehearsal for a bigger event that is like it. So there will be an echo of it in the future. It's a foreshadowing. And I've talked about the foreshadowing that we see in Isaiah on several occasions. So in the end, God will lead his people out of a spiritual slavery. Now, what event is that? Is that the gathering of the Jews in the Promised Land? Is that the removal of believers from culture? Is that the rapture? Is that other? Is that all of the above? And that I'm not clear on. That Isaiah hasn't been extremely helpful with. But the return from exile in Babylon has antecedents, but it's also a foreshadowing of events in the future that will be similar in some way. Okay, so what is the relevance of this for us? First of all, is the God who dealt with Israel is the God that we have to do with. It's the same God. And the character of God that's manifested in the Old Testament is the character of the God that we serve. We can learn a great deal about the God that we serve from looking at the Old Testament. Furthermore, we have the potential, in looking at Isaiah and other parts of the Old Testament, of gaining some understanding of what is coming. Both the big picture, understanding what God is doing in history in big, sweeping terms, as well as some details with respect to the future and what will be happening. We also can gain reassurance that things are well in God's hands. Things are proceeding right on schedule. And the relevance for this is that God does in history with the people of Israel what he does has many analogs in the life of the individual believer. There are many parallels, many similarities between what Israel experiences as a nation and what any individual believer experiences. That there's a sense in which every believer experiences an Exodus-like event. Every believer experiences a wilderness-like event, etc. So all of those things happening in history with respect to Israel are, to one degree or another, giving us a sense of what our spiritual exodus is all about. Okay, I got through as much as I had hoped to get through. So any questions or comments that you'd like to make? There is a little time.
You talked about the spiraling nature of the progression of Isaiah being kind of indicative of the progression of history.
Yeah.
Also kind of bookended between Genesis and the end of history. And the question that arose for me was about beginnings and ends on a spiral. Mm-hmm. Before the beginning, you said that it comes from chaos towards order. And I guess I'm wondering, in this process, in this spiraling process that ends in order but kind of precedes more chaos.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering what you believe, what you think the origin of chaos is and the purpose of it in this spiraling towards. Are we ever getting towards the end of history, or are we only ever moving towards more chaos?
Yeah. Well, I think the answer, I think, is absolutely. It gets over the course of history, the whole course of history. When we come to the end, there will be order. And the order in particular that is of significance is not just water will stay in the sea, but the order that will come is everything will be as it ought to be, and that's described as righteousness. That in the end, we make it to righteousness, that God is going to establish a righteous order with righteous people. So yes, that it's going there. Now, can you just look at history and see that that's the case? In some ways, no, you can't see that that's the case. But there is a proliferation of chaos. It keeps bursting out in history and seems to grow and mushroom. But I think that then comes back to the verse that in chapter 55, verse 8 and 9, I think is getting to that very thing. That for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. That if we really had perspective, the perspective that God has, we could see that things are indeed progressing according to plan. But from our perspective in history as finite human beings, that is not obvious. What do you mean, is there no chaos?
For God, it would seem that all should be ordered. So is chaos kind of a human thing? Like, are we the only ones that perceive chaos, and that for God on high, it's not really disorganized?
Oh, no. I think it absolutely it's disorganized, even from God's perspective. But it is disorder with the seeds of order in it. that he looks down, he sees the chaos that is there, absolutely. But he sees latent order or righteousness in it. Yeah.
David, it's the same passage on 8 when God says, "My ways are not your ways." Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of, when I haven't understood something or couldn't grasp something, I just kind of went back to that and said, "You aren't kidding, God. I mean, my mm-hmm. ways certainly aren't your ways."
Absolutely.
And then it makes sense, but God doesn't only have more pieces than we have. He's got all the pieces that mm-hmm. he can fit together and make sense out of this. But then you said that, but God is good and he's compassionate. And then just what you said previously, it seems like, yes, that will become obvious at the end. But if we're talking to a friend or something that starts pointing fingers at all the stuff and all the tragedy and suffering and stuff that's going on, I just don't think we can understand that rationally. Seems like we have to have faith that in the end it's going to shake out the way. So I guess that's my question. I mean, can we defend God in the reality in which we find ourselves living? Or do we just have to accept it on faith that when he says that his ways are not our ways, mm-hmm. we don't have all the pieces,
right.
that if we had all the pieces, then it would
right.
make sense to
right.
us?
The way I think about that is, I mean, it is hard to come up with a compelling defense for the evil that's in the world, come up with a compelling defense that defends God's goodness to someone who doesn't see that. But I liken it to, I've used this illustration before, but what if there were, or use a similar illustration, what if there's someone that you and I both know extremely well who's accused of doing something that we know would not be in fitting with their character, with the character of that person? We know this person extremely well, and this person would not have done that thing. It's hard to convince someone who doesn't know that person well that that act is out of character for that person. Because you have to know that person well to know that that would be out of character. It's only those that know him well that for whom that's compelling. And I think that's kind of the way it works with God. It's as we have logged time with God and we've seen him act in our lives and the lives of others that we become convinced that he is a good and loving God, even when there are things that happen out there that we have a difficult time explaining even to ourselves. How would a good God allow that to happen? But we put that into the context of everything else we know about God and we say, I don't know. I don't know how that fits together, but I'm confident he is a good God. But someone else coming in, if they don't have that experience with God and they've seen him work and stuff, it's a hard sell. I think that's just the way it is.
I guess I'm asking the same question from a different angle.
Okay.
When he says, My ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts. It's right on the heels of compassion and pardon.
Yes.
Is that one of the things that identifies that I'm not like you, I forgive?
Yeah, I think it is. That it's all of a package, and part of that package is it's not only do we not understand and can't make sense of the things that happen that under God's sovereignty they happen, and we can't explain it and put it together with God's character. But there are other things that he does that are not like us that we benefit from, his compassion and his pardon. And those are, we can't really fully understand those or make sense of that.
And when you were talking about chaos earlier, is it the chaos of putting all the parts for a clock in a box and shaking them up, where if you look closer, you realize there's only one thing that can become, and that's a clock.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at it, it's just not. It's mm-hmm. chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you meant by order hidden within that sort of thing?
Possibly, yeah. But, I mean, there is, I think it is, is there only one way that it could go? I don't know if there's only one way that it could go. But the order that's going to be is going to be an order that's consistent with the character of God. It's going to be consistent with what God values. And what's uppermost in that is righteousness. And righteousness is first and foremost, it's moral character. And it's so there's a premium put on moral character. When God establishes order and dispels chaos, what he's dispelling is rebelliousness and wickedness. And what he's establishing is the order of moral goodness. Okay, thanks.